Radio City, John Grayson here with you, Rob Ross, alongside from PopDose.com, doing a little talking about what's going on in the world this week, and we've got some great music to talk about, all kinds of fun things to do on the podcast this week, and Robert Ross, welcome back, man. How's everything going?
It's going, but so far, so good.
Yeah. Well, as we said, we've got some terrific music to kick off with, and I want to start with a young lady by the name of Kate Grum, because you have the review of her new album. It's called Heroin, and it's up online at The Dose right now. What a beautiful voice she has. Let's start there.
That is a good jumping off point, really. Her vocals are terrific. Her songwriting is terrific. Her structure of melody is terrific.
Yeah.
She is the total package. And I know that sounds horribly cliched, but really, this sounds like someone who isn't making a debut. It's someone who's a seasoned, I don't want to say pro, but somebody who's done this for a while and really has found her footing. I mean, she just comes right out of the box with an absolute grand slam. You know, it's one thing to be someone who puts out an album, a debut album, I should say, that has something special. But when you come out with your first album and you have a player on it, and I mean, this is just absolutely stupendous, like Stuart Smith playing guitars, etc., you know that they're in a special league of their own, really, from the very beginning. But just take one listen to the album. You pick any track, it's fine. I mean, personally, there's this one song called Tricks that I really like the most. It's one of the more upbeat songs, because there are some very low-key pieces. That's not diminishing the power of her vocal range or the emotions that come off in the songs. It's just that this is actually more of a, you know, band kind of kicking pop-ish track.
Right.
But, you know, it's got that radio-friendly feel. But she knows how to go from one end of the spectrum to the other, which is not an easy thing to do when you are coming up with your debut album.
Well, sure. And the fact that, I mean, she knows how to be understated when she needs to be. You mentioned that. I mean, there are the upbeat pop tracks on this record. There are also some things that are very thoughtful. The song Whistle Cry is one that's linked on the page with alongside the review on Pop Dose. And it's just, it's a beautiful piece of music. And you can tell that it seems very natural, and it's odd to find that balance where you can tell that a lot of work went into a song, and yet it feels like a very natural flow as well. It seems crafted. It doesn't seem built.
Right. It's all very natural. There's no forced here.
Right.
Something else to take into account. Okay, you've got somebody like Stuart Smith who's helping to drive this bus, but you have a producer like Stuart Lerman. And if people don't know, because people involved in music really should have a grasp on producers, whether they be from another decade or the here and now. I mean, he's worked with Marshall Crenshaw, Sean Colvin, Elvis Costello, Patti Smith. I mean, really, do I need to keep going?
Yeah.
But to put Kate Grum in that league is not a difficult thing to do.
Absolutely. You know, we're going to circle back to that comment you just made about producers in just a couple of minutes, too, because there are some things to go over there, and all the more reason why liner notes are such an awesome thing. In the meantime, we do have some more new music, though, and there's another one. You had a conversation with a gentleman that you've been listening to and I've been listening to for a very long time. We mentioned the Feelies and their new record last time we talked, and you got to sit down for a little while with Stan Demski and do some talking. Talk about, first of all of this came about. How did you end up talking with Stan?
Well, frankly, he and I have been Facebook friends for many years. We often discuss the possibility of meeting. We always have these kind of brief but funny conversations when he does his Sunday night cocktail mix, where he digs out old 45s, usually, and posts them. And you know how I label geek with such pathetic ease and regularity.
Right.
You know, I see a certain label and I go, ooh! And,
right.
You know, that really kind of helped to shape this even more. So the idea of interviewing Stan, because drummers don't often get their day. I hate to say it. There are a few that, of course, will always be spoken to quickly. I mean, one of our favorites, Jody Stevens, of course.
Yep.
Ringo,
yep.
You know, someone like Don Henley, somebody like that. But, you know, Stan's just a very nice, very low-key and incredibly kind and funny man. And having this chance to just have a little bit of a back and forth, and plus, there's something else. He's not just the drummer from the Feelies. You know, for me, what I've always thought was cool is the fact that, A, he's been in the band for now over 30 years, and they're on their 40th anniversary. He was in the band Luna, to mention one band of some note and merit.
Mm-hmm.
This is Gene Wareham's group, if people don't know, and I really don't want to have to do tangential explanations. But he was in a band called the Phosphenes, who were produced by Richard Barone back in the earlier part of the 80s. They were on Coyote Records, and I actually have had that EP that they put out for years. So, you know, it's just one of those things. I just wanted to ask him a couple of questions. And like I said, you could not have asked for better, I think funnier, and just very kind and patient. And he's just a very, very nice person. And I'm genuinely grateful to him for taking the time to do it.
Yeah, and you know what's funny too is that over the years with the conversations that you and I have both had with people in the music industry, you can tell how much easier a conversation is once they get the idea that you know what you're talking about, that you know who they are and you know what they did. You know, it's funny how many doors that opens. And what it always makes me wonder is how many interviews do these guys do with people who have no clue who they are?
Well, I don't want to go off on a tangent, of course, but I will, because a perfect example is when I spoke with Paul Weller.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's one of two trains of thought here. One is the what you just said about not having a clue.
Yep.
Which happens all too often and is uncomfortable and embarrassing to read if you're on that side of the fence. But then there's also the fanboy element, which makes you too much of
an insider.
Gushing, babbling.
Yeah.
Right? My approach towards that, and I should mention, you know, in prepping for it, when I got the word that I was going to be able to do this and to speak with him, his publicist here in the States at Warner Brothers said, you know, Paul is absolutely fine with talking about the Jam, the Style Council, whatever. So at least I knew if I wanted to approach it,
mm-hmm.
I could. Having said that, I made some reference to those periods, but I didn't go into depth because I thought, well, first of all, it's been done to death. You know, what's Paul going to say or reveal to me that he hasn't been asked or said before?
Yeah.
You know, and that's kind of a point of wasting his time, you know, in doing this interview. How I approached it was, when I started to really get the nerves, the fanboy shakes, if I want to call it what it really was, just as I was dialing the number, I thought to myself, okay, you're going to make a fool of yourself. So just think of him as what he basically is deep down inside. He's an old friend, because were it not for him, I wouldn't have gotten through my teen years.
Yeah.
That's not any kind of exaggeration. So when I started to talk to him, it was very relaxed and very, very easy and flowing. And I asked him, you know, I asked him the questions that really mattered the most, the here and the now, the how did you write this, why did you write this, and, you know, by taking it from that level to, okay, are there times when you feel like you might want to go back and listen to a different part of your career as a point of reference? That's when I approached the Jam, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
So There's a certain nuance, I guess you could call it, in doing this.
Right, and it takes just building that muscle. And it's funny because I get asked all the time, have you ever been nervous before an interview? And usually the answer is no, because I'm so into, I've got to get my stuff down. I've got to get this question and I've got to make sure. And it's all about, you know, building up beforehand and doing the prep work. But the one time that I was nervous before an interview was for Patty Boyd. And it was because, and I told her beforehand, I said, you know, I'm nervous as a cat right now about this. And she kind of laughed about it. She was very sweet, by the way. But it was just the idea that here's this woman who has inspired in Eric Clapton and Donovan and George Harrison and all these other people some of the greatest music I've ever heard in my life. She must be incredible. And I totally psyched myself out.
Well, you know, there's something else to consider, because what you just said absolutely rings true. You know, when there is somebody of that kind of, dare I say, magnitude,
yeah,
you can't help but feel overwhelmed by it. It's just impossible. It's like if you were going to sit down and have a conversation with any one of the presidents,
right,
bar this one, you know, you're going to get nervous. It doesn't matter how personable Barack Obama may be, or Bill Clinton, it's the, or even, you know, George Bush. It's the fact that this is a president. You
yep.
know, you're
yep.
talking to somebody who's, I hate to use the phrase because it sounds so corny, larger than life.
Exactly. So,
okay.
Yeah, it
but,
is.
I will tell you this much, and I'm going to make you laugh on two fronts. The first interview I ever did in my life was back in 1996. It was an in-person interview, and it was with the Ruddles.
Oh, that's great.
Okay. When they reformed to release, it was called Archaeology.
Yeah.
And in a word, I was shitting myself.
Uh-huh.
Because I went up there armed with a slew of Ruddles questions, and something made me think, just as I walked from my Atlantic Records office up to Virgin Records, maybe they don't want to do this in character. Ask the publicist. And when she said, you know, they would really love to not do Ruddles, you know, quote unquote, or I should say, all you need is cash questions in character, they would absolutely love to be interviewed as themselves. I actually crumpled what I had up and just winged it.
Good man.
And it was wonderful. And they were wonderful. 16 years later, my first interview after that was with Peter Holsapple. Was I nervous? Oh, you'd better believe it. And, you know, I was told that I was going to have 15, maybe 20 minutes tops on the phone with Peter. Peter and I were on the phone for about 45 minutes, and he could not be a lovelier person. And don't believe a word he says. He is a very sweet and kind and just an interesting man. And I could have talked to him for hours if he didn't have to go to work. I mean, we were talking about everything, you know, that wonderful little piece he was telling me about when he saw big, you know, the reformed big star on the Tonight Show. That was a coffee cooler, what do you call it, a water cooler moment mm-hmm. for him. It just so many great conversational bits. So it really depends on what frame of mind you put yourself into when you're about to go and do one of these.
Yeah, exactly. So it's funny, too, how sometimes the ones that you think are going to be tough end up being easy, and the ones you think are going to be a breeze end up being just a grind. So hey, it's something to keep in mind when you're reading these things, especially when you're reading the words on the page, because if you hear it happen on the radio or on a podcast, you can generally tell that things are a little bit more tense or less tense. So
I'll give you one more just to give you an even better laugh. You know it's going well when you've sat and you've taped 3 hours of a conversation and you've only written maybe an hour's worth because it's already over 5,000 words.
Right, because you just ended up friends.
That's the kind of stuff I have with Richard Barone, because we've done two quote-unquote formal interviews, two sit-down interviews, and the material I've used in both maybe equals an hour and change. The rest, you know, that was just stuff between two people having an incredible, fantastic conversation. And if I haven't said this before, he is one of the loveliest people on this planet. So.
Yeah, that's cool. And of all the people that that we've talked to over the years, for me personally, the one that I was surprised went as well as it did was John Cusack, because I had always heard what a tough interview he was, and I've seen him give some interviews that he clearly did not want to do, but he was fine. He was great, very personable, very upbeat, and that was cool. And of course, Tim Allen's an asshole. So that said, got a couple more things to talk about. Again, you're listening to Radio City on popdose.com. John Grayson here with you, Rob Ross alongside. And another review that you have up online this week is for a band called Lowland Hum and an album that they've got out now called Thin. And the thing that I thought was fascinating about this is, to kind of set this up a little bit, there's a song on Physical Graffiti called Black Country Woman. And at the beginning, you hear them kind of talking back and forth, and Robert Plant, you know, they say, oh, I got to get this airplane out of here. And he says, nah, leave it. That kind of thing went very much into making this album Thin. Talk first of all about who is Lowland Hum.
They are a couple. And they're a musical duo as well, and I do mean pretty much stripped down to a duo. Daniel and Lauren Goins from Virginia. And, you know, I was just fascinated by this record because of the textures of the guitar playing, the mm-hmm. acoustic guitar playing. It is so warm. And these two voices in some incredible harmonies and not standard arrangements. In other words, the first thought that came to mind with the vocal balance that wasn't done in harmony was the kind of tandem that Glenn Tilbrook and Chris Difford have when they're both singing the same melody.
Very
but
much.
But you can tell the big differences, of course, in their vocals. The other thing is Ms. Goins just has this amazing voice and a range that's so, it's so, I want to say haunting, and yet it goes right into you. It moves you. It can't, you can't help it. When you're listening to an album like this, you can't help but be moved. And there is an element to this that usually I wouldn't say keen on, but I tend to eschew a little bit more often than not. There's a certain religiosity to this, a certain spirituality that I'm all for putting spiritual themes in records or songs, I should say. But there are some themes that will tend to make me shy away a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, not so much. It made me basically embrace it because of the purity of the message that they were trying to put across. And I think that's what won me over in a spot where I usually would say, okay, you know what, I'm going to skip this one for
right.
the obvious reasons.
Right. Yeah, and that, again, to me, has always come back to, I hate to keep overusing this, but it comes back to balance. If you are trying to hit me over the head with a spiritual message, you're going to drive me away. If you're going to tell me what you think and how you view the world in a song, I'm right there with you.
No, that makes perfectly good sense. I mean, that's the whole thing is to not browbeat somebody.
Exactly, right. Know? But getting back
for argument's sake, I'm sorry, I was just going to say, for argument's sake, if it's such an overtly Christian or whatever message that's going in to the song, then, you know, let's face it, Bob Dylan didn't win me with Slow Train Coming.
Right. But the thing is, yeah, if you're clever enough and you're a good enough songwriter and you're a good enough wordsmith, I'm going to get where you're coming from. I don't need it laid out for me. I get it. I'm a pretty avid listener, so that's the way it should go. But getting back to the production values on this one, that's where they let life be life. As I understand it, they recorded a lot of this in places, at home, where you could hear life happen around it. You could hear dogs bark. You could hear lawnmowers
right.
in the neighborhood. And that's what I was talking about in the setup of this. I love that it's not sterile.
The whole naturalness.
Yes,
of it.
Yes.
You know, and that's, you know, you want to talk about doing things organically and listening to it, how stripped down it is, and yet how incredibly powerful and rich it is. You can balance the two very nicely.
Yep.
We imagined ourselves tiny.
How to do it.
Yeah, definitely. And so that's, again, all the more reason to pick this one up. And watch the trailer on the page, by the way, where they talk a little bit about that. It's Lowland Hum's album Finn, and the review is up there for you online at popdose.com, elsewhere on the site. You're listening to Radio City. John Grayson here with you, Rob Ross alongside. And Rob, we're going to get into politics in just a minute, but before we get there, I mentioned producers a little while ago, and it's funny, as a great reader of liner notes and just a gobbler of all of the information that's in these things over the years, it's funny the kinds of things that slip by you, and then you find out, you go, oh, it all makes sense now. You find out that, you know, like Paul Schaefer was involved in something or something like that. And one of my favorite songs from Warren Zevon has always been Roland the Headless Thompson Gunner. And I just found out a little while ago that one of the producers on that particular song was Waddy Wachtel. And I thought, you know, All of a sudden, it makes sense. It's funny how you can start to draw through lines, and you can tell when somebody was just an ear, and there's plenty of room for that, or somebody who had more of a musician sensibility as a producer.
I think George Martin, going back to the 60s, is considered the premier producer, and people do often tend to forget other producers' names afterwards, but I also tend to think of people like Shel Talmy,
yeah,
who produced The Who, The Kinks, the Creation. Ron Richards, who never seems to get his due, who made the Hollies sound so stupendous. Or Paul Samwell Smith, who was a bass player of the Yardbirds and then produced their one studio album with Simon Napier Bell and then went on to produce Cat Stevens very successfully. You know, these people had an imprint of their own, but for me, the real producers that I latched onto and embraced so fully definitely had to have been people like Hugh Padgham, who ran rampant in the early 80s by producing the likes of XTC, Phil Collins, The Police, you know, or Steve Lillywhite, who produced just about everyone.
Right.
And of course, probably my favorite producer, has to be said, was Mitch Easter, alongside of Don Dixon, but probably because of the emotional impact of Chronic Hound, Mitch Easter will always have a very special place in my heart for being someone who really kind of pointed the way for me and what I wanted to do production-wise. And producers, it's interesting because the late, great Jim Dickinson, who, of course, is having worked with Bob Dylan and the Rolling Stones and so on, is now being most well-known for having produced Big Star Third. He once made the very interesting statement that the producer's name should be in the smallest print on the back of the record, you know, in the very bottom corner, in the tiniest type known to mankind. The producer is not essential. As humbling as that statement was, that's bullshit, because listen to Big Star's number one record and Radio City. You listen to John Fry's production. Listen to the second verse of Back of a Car, and that should tell you everything. Listen to the clarity and the crispness of the track from the beginning. But there comes a point on the second half of that verse, in the second verse of the song, where Jody Stevens does what I call circling the drums. If you're in a car, the drums go all the way around all the speakers. And that was done back in 1973, 74.
Yeah.
And it still sounds just multi-million dollar today. Or Bob Mould and Lou Giordano's production on Copper Blue, the second finest produced album I can think of. You know, Waddy Wachtel is a fantastic producer, you know, not just with Warren Zevon, but with others,
yep,
let alone for the fact that he is such a motherfucker of a guitar player.
Exactly.
And arranger, you know?
Right.
So that's just one of many. Peter Asher, after all these years of being the Peter half of Peter and Gordon, was an incredible producer. You know, so these things have to be taken into consideration. You know, Glyn Johns, Bill Simcic, you know, X amount of producers out there.
And, you know, it also goes back to what we were talking about a little bit earlier with Lowland Hum and the fact that, you know, sometimes it's about what you leave in. Sometimes, you know, the mistakes and the so-called mistakes and the little bits of character that are in a song, it's about the groove. It's about the overall sound much more than it is about perfection. And that's something I think that's very much lost today. So
right. Well, perfection makes it antiseptic.
And exactly.
That's, if it's too finely tooled, forget it. There's no point. It's like using Auto-tune or remember MIDI when everybody started getting yeah, gaga about MIDI because it straightened,
yep,
out the bum notes, you
right,
know, the whole point is to fuck up every now and then. You want to hear a bum note. People hate working with Todd Rundgren, but that's what makes him a great producer.
Exactly. Yes, absolutely. Well, the other thing that you did just recently, we always talk about, again, more of the folks who are populating popdose.com and making this website what it is you had the opportunity to talk with one of the other editors. Who'd you catch up with?
I had the wonderful opportunity and good fortune to spend yesterday afternoon, or I should say Saturday afternoon, with D.W. Dunphy. And, you know, I have to say, with a lot of appreciation and an infinite amount of respect, and I hope he doesn't take this the wrong way, he's just an incredibly lovely and good person. And I so appreciated the time that we got to not only spend together and talk, but to do a little bit of record hunting, because I don't remember the last time that I was at Vintage Vinyl in Fords, New Jersey. Now, DW lives in Jersey. I live in Staten Island. So it may be over 2, possibly 3 years since I was there. And I can't tell you how many times I'd been there previously, because it was in the hundreds over the years.
Yeah.
But we were rifling through the bins and just talking about various, you know, things that we were looking at. And lo and behold, I mean, amongst all the musical elements and bits and pieces, they have a lot of 45s, original 45s, $3.99, $2.99, $4.99. The shittier looking the sleeve, even though the records themselves look pristine, they were there. And I got to admit, I didn't spend any money. I didn't buy any. But would that I could have, I would have walked out with a box full of singles. Because just to illustrate to you what we were finding, and it was great to make him laugh for a moment. We're just flipping through these random singles, and I look and I see, Atco Records, the Bee Gees, Lamplight. And I said, 1st of May, and then he takes a look, and he's like, yeah. And then I see the next one, Epic, the old yellow label. Signs That Will Never Change, the Hollies. Carrie Ann, yep. You know, and we're going through all of these original 45s that were there. The original Abneck Records pressing of Western Union Man by the Five Americans. You know, it was stuff like this that was just absolutely mind-blowing to find it there, waiting to be taken home. And I do hope that somebody had the foresight and taste to do what we should have done, but were wise enough not to.
Yeah,
but the fun was really in, I have to say, we didn't rifle through as many CDs as we did vinyl. And a part of the conversation, of course, was my whole label thing, because, you know, you're looking at some of these are brand new reissues. You know, things like the Byrds catalog or the Jam. Okay, just to give you two from one end of the spectrum to the other. You know, these are Sony Music special products, legacy releases by the Byrds. But to see the Jam albums with the Polydor logo, the way that I remember the albums being, of course, I've got the original, you know, British and American releases made in the Czech Republic. You know, that was kind of a mind fuck. But,
yeah.
You know, and of course, up on the walls, festooned, we did one of those got it moments.
Sure.
Of originals, you know, the Yardbirds Little Games on Epic, because that was the only place that was originally released here in Canada. The Who sellout on Decca, which I have, of course. A whole slew of original Kinks albums on Reprise. You know, just a ton of things that immediately catapulted me back to my very obsessive 14 and 15-year-old self and those Saturdays when we'd all troop into the village and go to places like Village Oldies or Golden Disc and plump down, you know, at the time it was a lot of money, $12 for a copy of Kink's Kingdom, or having a rave up with the Yardbirds because, you know, in the 70s, that was a lot of bread for an old album that was out of print, but they were all still in shrink wrap. And, you know, we found a couple of things. Paul Weller's new soundtrack to this movie Jawbone, which was already available on vinyl, not on CD yet. So that was another, you know, another find. And again, I didn't buy it, but it was the whole idea of the two of us being able to spend some time together, because I've not had the good fortune until yesterday of meeting anyone from Pop Dose face to face. And I'm awfully glad that I was able to connect with DW and you know, share conversation and a great lunch and two music people. We were in our element.
Good
and
man.
That I'm incredibly grateful. So thank you very much, DW.
Excellent. Well, and that's very cool. You know, and there are those moments. And even in the CD racks now, a buddy of mine a couple of weeks ago hit me on Facebook and said, do you have this? And underneath that was a copy of the Refreshments Wheelie in the $5 bin at one of the local record stores. And for reference, for folks who are not fans or not fans yet of the Refreshments, that's about a $200 CD. So
I have to say to you, you just said something, of course. One of the hardest records to find on any level was Paul Weller's first solo single, Into Tomorrow, backed with, I think, Here's a New Thing,
uh-huh.
the song. It was a completely independent release in 1991 on his own Freedom High label. Of course, it wasn't released here, but, you know, if you found it, great. It was easier to find the vinyl, first of all. But
yeah.
Do you remember GEMM.com, Gem.com, Global
yeah.
Electronic Musical Marketplace? Okay. I saw a copy of it for something like, and this is going back to 1997, 1998, whatever the hell it was, where people were asking upwards of $150, $200 for just this two-song CD single. I was with a friend of mine in his local record store in, I think it was outside of New Hope, Pennsylvania. This is going back now, or at least 10 years, if not more.
Mm-hmm.
In the cutout bin. Lo and behold, there's the CD single of Into Tomorrow.
That's...
How much was it, John?
Oh, it's $2.99?
$6.99, but okay.
Well, that's right. You were paying those New York premiums. I forgot. So, yeah. That's outstanding. Oh, man. See, and that's why you do it. That's what crate digging is all about. That's very cool.
Even at 52, I can find myself becoming him again, that young man who was once full of life and vim and vigor and a desire to just own any great record that he thought was great, whether it was the Kinks or the Yardbirds, the Hollies, Jam, the Undertones, the Buzzcocks. Oh, we could spend hours talking about some of the psychotic hunts that we went on for specific records. That was the joy of it. The fun was the obsession of trying to track it down, you know, like what holy grail this week, basically.
John Grayson and Rob Ross here with you talking a little bit about what's going on this week. And we've got a whole bunch of different directions to go off into. But we would be remiss if we didn't mention the absolute fiasco that happened at the end of the Oscar broadcast a little over a week ago. I normally am not an award show person, and I have to confess, I fell asleep just before, about 5 minutes before the end. We had to rewind and watch it again. So I missed it live, but what an unbelievable botch of something that should be so easy.
Like you, I am not an awards show person. I do not give a single shit about the Oscars. You and I had this conversation about the Grammys. You know, once REM got shafted in 91, that was the end for me.
Yep.
So, you know, my opinion of awards show are very low. Hence, I wasn't watching it. I was watching The Walking Dead and then Talking Dead, as every good American should have been doing. And because it's either that or watch Homeland, where Carrie makes the freak out face and starts crying, and then watch Billions afterwards, where her old squeeze Brody is now a multi-billionaire douchebag. But I just had to throw that in there for comedic effect. But the Oscars fiasco, I thought, was just an absolute, talk about a royal fuck up.
Yeah.
You know, I hate to use a moment from a movie like A History of Violence, but in the immortal words of William Hurt, how do you fuck this up?
You had one job. You had one job, dude. And of course, they went and fired the guy who screwed it up. But still, I mean, it's so completely inexcusable. And the fact that, I mean, you had the two that were standing there on stage trying to decipher what the hell that was all about, and trying to read that envelope, and they had no other choice but to just say, okay, well, looks like La La Land, sure, whatever. And it got bad from there. And the fact that, you know, the real tragedy, I think, in that is just that, not that the folks who made Moonlight had their moment stolen from them, but that they didn't even get to give the kind of speech that you normally would at that point.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you work really hard on a movie, and, you know, In the grand scheme of things, when you are accepting an award, it's, you know, it's nice for the recognition, and it's nice to acknowledge the people who helped get you there, where you're accepting this award, whether it's the people in the production team, the actual actors, the writers, your family, whatever the case may be. And yeah, it's both a crime and a shame that they really didn't get their moment in the sun as deserved.
Not to mention the fact that you got the people who made La La Land going, oh shit, we won.
Yeah, it's embarrassing for them, and I feel equally bad for them being put in that very awful and awkward position. And I also thought it was I thought it was completely unfair that Faye Dunaway and Warren Beatty had to suffer some lumps, because that wasn't their doing.
Oh,
they were asked to read an envelope.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the fault of the person who handed them the envelope. It's that simple.
Yeah, it's just terrible. But I don't know. I mean, Steve Harvey, I thought it was funny that he reached out to Warren Beatty and said, hey, if you need me, I'm here for you, buddy. So that was kind of cool. Yeah, I like that dude. We've got plenty more coming up on the broadcast, and we have so much to talk about that has been going on over these last, even just the last few days, as the presidential administration, it continues to just frankly step on its own dick. And there seems to be no end in sight to any of this. And so now we've got Donald Trump accusing Barack Obama of wiretapping Trump Tower. And, again, no context, no evidence, no anything. All we have is just this series of insane tweets. And that seems to be what we're in for the next 4 years.
You know, the other night, I saw George W. Bush on a couple of TV shows.
Yeah.
And like so many other people, God help me, all I could think was, fuck, I miss him.
I know. It's like, I kind of miss that dude. Yep.
I mean, what I found fascinating in these few moments of the interviews that I saw, here was a man who's obviously a very kind person, and I don't think I've ever heard actually a bad word ever spoken about the man himself.
As a person, sure.
People genuinely like and or love him. He's a very kind and good person. He was very misguided and not good as a president. He was in way over his head. And the fact is, as the joke went on for so many years, you know, Jeb was the anointed son, really. It just so happened that W got the job. W said, well, my dad didn't get Saddam Hussein, but I will. You know, all of that, he did things the wrong way. Nothing's ever going to change my opinion of Cheney and everybody else in that cabinet.
And what they did, right.
Right. But W himself, I've never had any sort of animosity towards. I always felt that he was almost an observer, because he wasn't tall enough to reach the wheel.
Right. Well, you know what's funny about that is that my mom has actually had a fair amount of personal experience with him, and she said that in those meetings, in the meetings with the committee that she's on, she said he was very intense, much more so than you would think. That the attempt was made. I mean, he was fully plugged into the want to of the job. But as you said, I mean, he had so many different forces that were yanking at him in 17 different ways, and he was in over his head. So it's kind of sad. You wonder what he could have done had he been an A student.
And the other thing is that I think because he's been away from it for so long now, he's able to step back and look at it and put some deeper thought into it. And I appreciated the things that he said, but certainly I love the fact that he shows his respect and in a very calm and quiet way, put Donald Trump in his place as far as the intelligence community goes.
Right.
And the press. Now, having said that, I have no idea what the fuck the president is thinking. Your guess is as good as mine, because that fucking moron is just making things worse and worse with every stupid tweet he sends, with every stupid thing that comes out of his mouth. What I find stunning is that, taken in the grand scheme, let's say all things are equal, the speech he gave the other night could be considered a turning point.
It was fine.
You know? Right. It was presidential. There were a few elements of it that I thought that were unnecessary, but what president doesn't go unnecessary?
Exactly.
You know, every one of them says something. Oh, did you have to go and say that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, fine. But almost the minute afterward, you go back to shooting yourself in the foot again by sending out these goddamn tweets that reek of paranoia and are filled with more defense of Russia. You know, the bottom line is Trump has never cared for making America great. The only thing he cares about is making money and Russia as much of an ally as possible, so it lines his pockets further.
Exactly. And it's just, I mean, it's as bad as this last round of tweets about all of the wiretapping and all of this bullcrap. Where it comes from is, apparently it was a report, obviously enough, on Breitbart that came from a right-wing talk radio show. He's the president of the United States. He has at his fingertips the intelligence community. He has daily briefings. He has everything that you could possibly want. And where does he get his information from? Talk radio and Breitbart. What kind of shit is that?
Well, I mean, that's the whole thing. He's nubs and shits on the mainstream press, and I'm going to use mainstream in quotation marks, and he's been shitting on the intelligence community.
Right.
So I think it kind of shows right right from the get-go where he stands.
Yeah, this conspiracy theory bullshit. I've had enough. And unfortunately, we're going to get more whether we've had enough or not. So all the more reason to keep track of where the actual facts are. And as we continue on Radio City, we've got a whole bunch more to talk about. We want to spend some time plugging what else is going on Popdose as well, because when we were doing this on the radio, used to talk every week about the fact that this is a very, very talented and very capable and just a lot of fun staff at Popdose that brings you the world of pop culture, and want to spotlight a couple of things, one of which is another one of the podcasts that you hear here on Popdose that comes out of Dave Metzger. Tell us what we've been missing on Dizzy Heights.
Well, you know, the thing is, it's something that shouldn't be missed. I mean, it's, you know, the last time he did the remixes, and now, you know, it was a bunch of older remixes. But, you know, he plucks things that he finds interesting and digs. And, you know, he brings up names that I haven't heard in years or names that I see frequently on XM radio. Case in point, Loxley, who are a great British-sounding band. But if I'm not mistaken, I think they're from New Jersey, you know?
Yep.
But then he digs up the Primitives. And I'm not talking about the pre-Velvet Underground, Velvet Underground. I'm talking about the British band from that very late 80s boom when all these bands seemed to have really attractive girl singers fronting the group.
Yep.
You know? But the thing is that, you know, David is a very thoughtful guy. And when he does the podcast, when he does Dizzy Heights, he likes it to flow, I think, seamlessly. He threads the songs together and why they work together. You know, so the simple truth is, I don't think people need to know too much about the podcast, except there it is on Popdose. It's lovingly crafted. Give it a listen. It's like listening to Matt Wardlaw's podcasts when he puts them up.
Right.
You know, just click on it and listen. And no different than us. You know, if you want to hear a conversation that will hopefully make you think, laugh, and piss you off at the same time while prompting you to go to the record store or buy some books, by all means, listen to us. That's what it's there for. But I think Dizzy Heights is a really fantastic vehicle.
Yeah.
So people should be tuning into it. Now, having said that, there's a terrific article by Robert Cass about the movies from this last particular week in 1997. And, you know, it was 20 years ago. And it's, you know, it's hilarious because, first of all, you're thinking of films that came out that you go, oh, holy shit, I forgot that one. And it really sucked.
Right. Or I can't believe that was 20 years ago.
And I mean, he pulled up some that I just, as I was scrolling through and reading, I was thinking, what the fuck? You know, here's two for you that'll make you either hurl or laugh, you know, and that's Beverly Hills Ninja, okay, or
yep.
Metro with Eddie Murphy.
Right.
Right? Now, there's two turds in the bowl immediately. But then you go into some of the bigger ones of that year. The English Patient, which I saw later on, I thought, okay, you know, it's fine. It wasn't anything bedazzling. I just had a thing for Kristen Scott Thomas, so
right.
I watched it.
How can you not?
You know. But then there was Evita, which made me want to, you know, I unfortunately, and I will spin this yarn, was dragged mercilessly on Christmas Day to go see it with the woman I was dating at the time.
Oof.
And, you know, she was always into those big, gaudy musical. Well, she was into big, gaudy Broadway musicals. She was in, you know, the less said, the better, for the sake of diplomacy and not wanting to be sued for saying anything inappropriate. But she dragged me to this fucking movie. And when I tell you that my ass was numb for 3 hours watching this fucking turd where it's just singing and no storyline,
yeah.
I didn't need to see Madonna, you know, singing, you know, Don't Cry For Me, Argentina. You know, all I ever needed was the commercial, which I'm sure you remember from the 70s,
right.
Of Patti LuPone and then good old Mandy Patinkin as, you know, what was his name? Chase Stadium, you know, doing that line about you were supposed to be immortal. That's all they wanted. Not much to ask for, you know?
Yeah,
that's
right.
It. I don't need to see this fucking movie. I don't care about Eva Perón. I'm sorry. And, you know, I have no beef with Madonna whatsoever.
Right.
But this, no, fuck that noise. Now, you go down a bit further and you got shit like Jerry Maguire and Scream and blah, 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 blah. But then you get a real classic like Beautician and the Beast. And that's just absolutely horrifying.
And Scream. I mean, Scream was also involved in that in the article. And, you talked about the fact that you had a thing for the woman and the English Patient. How could you not watch Scream and think, boy, Neve Campbell is just cute?
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, we all, the only reason why I ever would tune into Party of Five, for fuck's sake.
Right,
just to
right.
see her. But, but then you have the biggie. And it's coming now. Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
Special Edition. Which pissed me off so badly. Because I didn't, first of all, and this is, here it comes. I think you can hear it in the distance. I'm dragging out my soapbox. From the moment it hit videotape in, 1983?
Yeah.
It was called Episode 4, A New Hope. No, fuck you, it's Star Wars. That's it.
Right.
Full stop, Star Wars. This special edition shit where Han Solo's talking to Jabba the Hutt, The only scenes with Jabba I ever want to see is with him going, Shuda.
Right, and Leia in that steel bikini.
Of course, but Lucas really fucked with perfection.
Well, yeah.
He really did.
I don't need bigger explosions. The explosions were fine. That was, and I don't need more Banthas than there were in the original. The number of Banthas was absolutely perfect. There's an axiom for that somewhere. It was fine.
Right. And by the way, the answer to the question is Greedo was a lousy shot, and I'm putting an end to that fucking argument once and for all. Now, next point is, by doing the Star Wars special edition horseshit, and then of course following it up with Empire, and then that complete cock up of what they did at the very end of Revenge of the Jedi,
mm-hmm.
its proper title.
Right.
Even though we all know that Jedi aren't vengeful, blah blah blah. Yeah, they have to be because it's about survival.
Right.
By putting in what's his name. What was the name of the kid who played Mannequin Skywalker? Hayden Planetarium, or whatever the fuck his name is. That was mortifying. The fact that they cut out Sebastian Shaw, that was embarrassment number one.
Yep.
When he, of course, was, I am your father, Luke. The fact that they changed the music from the cute little Ewok furry bear dancing music to that fucking Peter Gabriel shit,
mm-hmm.
or Peter Gabriel styled shit, whatever it was, that kind of, new agey fucking world music garbage. Why?
Right.
Just why?
Yeah.
Explain to me. Please explain.
There is no reason. And I mean, if you're going to remake a movie. I don't think they needed to be remade. But if you're just going to sit there and dick around with it, with the one that you already made, I mean, you should have done it right the first time, or you shouldn't have released it if that's the way you felt about it. But, he's never going to quit, unfortunately. So,
he shit all over The Force Awakens, so fuck him.
Exactly. Rob Ross, John Grayson, talking it over. It's Radio City here, and we've got a new one of these for you each and every week here on Popdos. So thank you so much for listening to this one, and we've got some things to look forward to as well, because next time we get together, we're going to talk about a new box set. What is it?
Yeah, this one was one of those nice beefy sandwiches that, even though I've got the old vinyl, and I have the one compilation that was released in this country, the wonderful people at Numero Records, the folks that gave us the Orc box sets, both the vinyl singles and then the CD/album compilation,
mm-hmm.
are about to unleash the complete definitive box set of one of my favorite bands, especially from my youth, The Creation. Remixes, stereo remixes that had never been available before, a hardcover book, extensive liner notes, pictures that have never been seen. I mean, this is just gorgeous. Anything Numero puts out is kind of like the way that Omnivore or Sundazed approaches their releases, and of course Rhino. It's done with a lot of love and care and diligence and detail and refinement, but it's The Creation. And you and I will spend a good portion of our next conversation talking about The Creation, because they played a major role in my very formative years when I was in my first band. Because, when I was in that band, I went out and got a violin bow to play guitar with.
Attaboy. Very good. So we'll look forward to that. And we've got a whole bunch more coming up for you. So always some new music to break. And in the meantime, check out the columns that we talked about. Dizzy Heights out from Dave Metzger, the other podcast. And of course, Robert Cass's Box Office Flashback. And there's 1997 up now. There's more of them up there. So check those out as well. And just kick around Poptos. Have yourself a good time. And Rob Ross, we'll look forward to talking to you again next week.
As always, God willing, and you take care of yourself, and I'll talk to you soon, John.
You got it. Thanks a lot. There's plenty more to come, and make sure you're around here with us next week on Radio City on Poptos.com.